Just a reminder that This Week in Media is brought to you by Hover.com.
Hey everyone, welcome back to This Week in Media. This is Alex, and we are streaming live from NAB. We're taking over the Twit booth, and I'm here with an illustrious crew to talk about NAB. Of course, my partner in crime, Tim Street. Hey, Tim.
Hey.
Who's not from coming in from L.A.?
Not today. It's Vegas, baby.
It's Vegas, baby.
So
Tim here is with me. Also, Darren Accato. Hey, Darren.
Hey, good to see you, Alex.
Good to see you. I've seen more of you in the last 3 days than I have in the last year.
Exactly. I know.
It's fantastic. Yeah. It's great. Andy Beach.
Hey, Alex. How you doing?
Hey. Good to see you. And Larry Jordan.
Welcome. 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 Good to see you again face to face. It's always fun.
Yeah, I've seen more of Larry in the same way.
Most people would say too much, actually, of Larry.
We've all been circulating through the Twit booth. Of course, Twit has a big booth right at the bottom of South Hall, right at the front of South Hall.
The skybox.
It really does feel like a skybox.
It's like a luxury box here.
It's not a green screen. There's not a green screen here.
I will say that I did suggest it. When someone said, like, how do you want to do this? I'm like, you don't really have to do this at NAB. We just put a camera out here, run a feed, and do a green screen, and then
we
call it a day.
Get everybody here at the right place at the right time.
That's true.
Yeah, but
it is kind of nice.
We're part of the group now.
There you go.
People can see that you're as famous as you are. That's the important thing, is to enhance your reputation.
We're all here. So, and for those of you watching live, if you're watching this right now on pixelcore.tv/live, if you put questions into the IRC that are there, some of them will end up on my phone. And I'm not looking at the IRC directly, but Carolyn is looking at that, and she's going to be posting there. So if you have questions about the things that we're talking about, then I can try to answer some of those. So check that out. Of course, we've got a couple big things happening. We've got lots of stuff with cameras that we're going to get to. We've got distribution things to talk about. But one of the big stories, of course, is Final Cut 10. Final Cut Pro 10 was. We talked earlier about whether it was X or 10. It was very confusing. Larry, give us a 10,000-foot view of what Apple did.
What Apple did is they totally redesigned the entire application from the ground up to redesign the entire interface and design every way that the application works. What they did is they said, what would happen if we created a brand new nonlinear application today with the tools that we have today? Full 64-bit support, which means that now we can have unlimitedly large projects, support for multiple processors, background rendering, no waiting for stuff to happen, native editing support for just about everything, including BIC pens. So it is a total revisualization of what a nonlinear editing system is. Because it's such a dramatic change, it instantly polarized the 1,700 people that saw it last night.
I think most of them polarized to the positive.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The guys that make the most noise are the ones that are polarized negatively.
Right.
And then there's the people that have to feel that they have to say positive things to compensate for the guys that are being negative. And what I'm hoping is by the time the fur dies down over the next couple of days, that everybody adopts a wait-and-see attitude. Because it isn't until Apple gets farther along. This was a sneak peek. That's the one key thing that, because I talked to the Apple executives after the presentation was over. They said this is a sneak peek that allows us to show you what we're doing with the interface, but it's not baked yet.
No, it's got to be pretty close to being cooked because it's due in June.
Well, Larry, except, let me just say that I had the great honor of going up to Cupertino 6 weeks ago to see, boy, this is a really tight mic. You got to get on top of this thing.
It's great. It's great in big crowds.
Excuse me 1 second. I'm going to swallow the mic. When I saw the presentation in Cupertino in February, the demo was exactly the same. And what I found out is the demo they ran last night was exactly the same build of the software that we saw in February. So that was a demo build. Since then, engineering has been working full-time to create something new. But what we saw was the February edition. It wasn't the April edition.
It was the last stable version.
Well, no, but it was...
No. Just saying, everything's a work in
progress.
It's a work
in progress. The
point is they got one to a point where they were happy. They locked off some of the code, made sure, tightened down some of the hatches, and made sure that one was actually going
to
work.
But it was a really very focused demo. There's a lot of areas that they didn't go. They went to very specific places to show things that we hadn't seen before. The magnetic timeline, which is something that just leaves my jaw on the floor. Or the ability to composite clips and the other stuff that we talked about. But it was absolutely a sneak peek. It's not at all the finished application.
So, Larry, the rumors that were coming out earlier were, this is iMovie Pro. I was hearing that everywhere. How did what you saw last night, how does that compare to iMovie Pro?
I love that question because at first blush, they're exactly the same. And I was talking to Greg Clark with Intelligent Assistance this morning, and he said, I got to show you something. This is what Quartz Composer looked like in the last version. And this is what Quartz Composer, which is how you build all of your interfaces inside OS X now, looks like. It's the exact same black screen. It's the exact same kind of highlights. It's the exact same kind of colors. So what they've done is their foundational building blocks are bricks. When you build something out of bricks, it's going to look like a brick house. It's not going to look like wood. So iMovie and Final Cut are built from the same core technology. They will look similar, but they don't have similar functions. As Richard Townhill, who was the MC of last night's event, he's the senior director of product marketing for the Pro Apps, he said, we would not launch an application that wasn't a Pro application at NAB to the Final Cut user group at the NAB Super Meet if we weren't interested in selling it to pros because they'd take us apart. I mean, it's the wrong place to launch iMovie Plus.
Right, and one of the things is what I think is useful is that many of the iMovie paradigms, many of the way that that people have started to play with that, you do see the same approach in the new Final Cut. And I think that is good news for people who are just getting into editing and they're learning iMovie. When they move, because right now you go from iMovie to something completely foreign. You know, if someone gets good at iMovie and they get good at editing, they move to Final Cut and it's just a random. It's completely random. You were saying,
When iMovie first came out, I mean, I was using Final Cut Pro. I also used the old version of iMovie. I still cannot wrap my head around the paradigm of iMovie when it was redesigned.
Right.
It's. I know
I said you are going to learn this, and I did.
And how was it?
It was great.
It's fast.
Yeah.
I have to admit, I looked at it with the new iMovie when it came out, and I was like, oh, this is a huge step backwards, and I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. And then as an example, I said, okay, I'm going to cut something, I have a pile of stuff. I'm going to cut it in Final Cut, and I'm going to cut it in iMovie. And so I cut this piece together in iMovie, and then I went to cut the same thing in Final Cut, and what I realized is in the amount of time it took me to do the entire edit in iMovie, I was just setting up my clips in Final Cut. And then I realized that, okay, well, there's a lot of things for me to learn, but it's a pretty fast approach. And I think one of the things that we're seeing, I think that the new Final Cut, some of the people that are going to benefit the most from it really could be the people who really have to turn things around quickly. You know, when we're looking at, and that's a big part of our industry now.
It is, yeah. Especially in post, and now with all these cameras that are putting images out instantly, it's going to put that added pressure to get it edited. So, if you can turn it around faster with this, new version, new paradigm, new interface, then great.
Andy, were you at the event?
I wasn't at the event, but I was just going to ask, do you think it's fair to say they took some of the learnings out of the iMovie stuff and have just applied it into the Pro Apps world now?
Yeah, I mean, it really did feel like they, the underpinnings, they obviously worked with it's a general technology, it's Quartz Composer, it's a general technology that's being used for both of them. And the advantage of that now is you improve that underlying technology and you improve both of them. They're not on two different tracks. One has just got a ton more features and a lot more complexity. The complexity that a professional needs to really do professional level work.
But I think you're also seeing the impact that Randy Ubelos has, because he was introduced as the chief architect for video applications, and
right.
By having one person in charge of all the video, there's going to be a common theme that runs through all the different video applications that Apple puts together.
Well, it's very clear that this is his vision of editing.
And he
has a very long pedigree. I mean, for those of you listening, he was in the Premiere team. He was in the original Final Cut team. I mean, this guy's been, if you're going to have anybody have that single vision, he's the right guy to be thinking about it, and even if we don't always agree with every piece of it.
I was sitting next to two VPs of engineering for Apple And they were having as much fun at the event as any other user was, because they were seeing the public viewing of stuff they've been working on for years. But I was talking to one of them before the show started, and I said, you know, what always fascinates me is that software is simply the embodiment of a philosophy. What's your philosophy of video editing? And this is the embodiment of Apple's philosophy of what video editing should be.
Well, you know, speaking of philosophy, it's you take a look at the way they're distributing this. And that, there, you know, the other grumblings that I heard are from distributors who now don't have the opportunity to distribute Final Cut Pro because it's a download from the App Store. And that's really a big shift in the marketplace.
It's only a download. That's the absolute only way you can do it now.
At $299. So we didn't talk about that before on this show, but so yeah. $299
No. That's all they've announced so far.
Oh, so that you might get more bells and whistles for more money? I'm feeling
it is. It is entire. It is entire. Well, the problem is, I do know some, but I don't know this. So this is a guess. But by making it on the App Store, one point that you made on Twit this morning, Alex, I thought was really good, is they've sort of set the high end of the bar for what people can charge for software on the App Store. But there's no way you're going to be able to download libraries of files like we have with Motion or with Soundtrack or with DVD Studio
right.
Pro.
Mm-hmm.
This is just a non-functioning way of. So why
Possibly.
Not?
Possibly.
But
because
here's
the thing is,
center,
is, that, is
right?
that remember that we pay $5 for Xcode and we download 4 gigabytes of information. So
I think I had 65 gigs in my Final Cut install the last time I checked, though. I mean, that's
you just have to be, you know,
patient.
Patient.
Yeah, a little half hour to an hour by the time.
Not a problem.
But the only point that I'm making is you cannot assume that because it's sold in the App Store, it is only sold in the App Store. And that there's no other way of bundling it. All they did is they just announced the most dramatic way of selling it. Because I don't think they're going to turn their back totally on system integrators, because video is way too much a system integrator market.
Are they selling, well, here's the question is, are they selling Pages?
Yes.
Anywhere other than the App Store? I don't know
if they are anymore.
I think that, I mean, Apple's commitment is that people are going to be buying stuff on, you know, via the App Store. You know, that is the, I mean, I think that they may not say it.
Their commitment this week. But remember when they said, we're only going to sell suites when Final Cut Pro Studio showed up. And that lasted for 3 iterations, and now suddenly we're not selling suites anymore.
I remember when they made laser printers. Those were really nice.
Oh, yeah.
So we have a question from online, and folks watching the live feed. Is this new Final Cut Pro considered more user-friendly?
Apple would say yes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what kind of user you are.
I think if you're brand new, it's going to be really, really friendly. The big challenge that all of us have, well, at least me, is trying to forget what I know
right.
and to learn something new. And the forgetting is going to be harder than the learning.
Well, the older you get, the easier it'll be to forget.
Well, yeah. Remember when we went from...
I think I don't like you anymore.
Aw, there.
Remember the transition to OS X?
Yeah.
How fast was it for any of you to wrap your head around that? Because for me, it was hard. It
right.
was tough. I mean, I'd learned everything about the old OS, how to get around problems,
yep.
how to use it really, really well. When OS X came out, I knew the advantages, but when I installed it, I felt like I didn't know anything.
I felt mentally challenged,
yeah.
I think
yeah.
was the term.
I mean,
well,
I felt,
and this
exactly.
is really going to be like learning a new application. I mean, this is really a... I think that's going to be it's a very different approach. And I think that the folks that are the hardest and the folks that we have to see what happens, but that they may lose to some degree, are the folks who came from Avid to Final Cut.
Mm-hmm.
They're high-end editors at Hollywood. They, you know, editing is a certain process, and it's a way that they approach it. And Final Cut has become the ends of their fingers, you know, and they can type through it. For them, I think this is a massive change, and I think that it's going to be interesting to see how they handle that.
Two thoughts here. In the February meeting, I can't share the guest list, but if you were to put a who's who together of who's in Hollywood, let me just say that there were not a lot of independent people sitting in that
okay.
room.
Very good.
So I think Apple is very interested in what, quote, the professional editor
And was
needs.
The response good?
There was a lot of... It's like all things. You see, here's the challenge that we've got. This is how we earn our living.
Right.
It is not simply me learning Pages. I can use Word. This is how I pay the rent. And I've got to learn this fast enough to be able to meet my deadlines and continue paying the rent and paying salaries. There's a whole level of additional pressure on learning this software that doesn't exist with many others.
Well, I definitely think there's going to be a progression here. I don't think we're going to see an adoption where suddenly everybody's doing everything in Final Cut.
No, it's the same thing with any. Even if it was perfect, I'd still tell people wait 3-4 months for a .1 release to come out, because Apple always has to tweak a .0 release. So if you want advice, you should absolutely watch what's going on, but don't buy the upgrade for real work until you get a .1 release.
Well, I wonder if you could have. I mean, you know, since making the adoption going to it, I wonder if you can have both the old Final Cut and the new version coexist on your machine.
I think the problem is
machine,
but
there's going to be, I imagine, drivers. There's going to be all kinds of confusion.
I think you probably have them coexist, because I think they live in such different code bases. But one of the things that I think is going to, we had a question last night when we were streaming live from the actual event, was do you think that it'll be backwards compatible? Like, you can open up a file in Final Cut 10 and go back, and I was like,
probably not.
I don't. Yeah. I think that once you move to the into the new world, you're in the new world.
You know, if you look at the way Apple has marketed Final Cut Pro over the years, they find a big editor, a big movie editor, to use Final Cut on a big high-profile project, and then they get that word out there that that movie was cut, you know, Cold Mountain was cut using Final Cut Pro.
So now they
have to redo that all over again, because where they make their money is from the wannabes, from the wedding.
Yeah. Well, it's not just here's what I say. It's not just the
wannabe filmmakers.
Well, I don't think
the big sales.
I'll argue that that's not actually where they make their money. Is the wannabe filmmakers? They make their money from the educational,
the
corporate,
and the iPhone,
you know,
and the iPad.
Yeah, people doing development for all these other sources that are not really, I mean, their business is something completely different. Maybe they, in the back of their head, they want to be filmmakers, but their real business is something.
That attainable goal is the way that they market the product, making it sexy.
Yeah, and one of the questions we had is, will motion work on with Final Cut? We don't know anything about motion yet.
And they specifically said that they're not talking about any other application except Final Cut last night, which gets back to that sneak peek we were talking about.
Right.
And they say there's more coming in this space, but they are ducking every single one of those questions.
Yeah. Hypertext didn't come up. They weren't
Hypertext. Supercard, actually, if you remember Supercard.
Supercard. Oh, yeah.
Another question from the live audience. Will new hardware be required to get the best out of Final Cut 10?
You're definitely going to need an Intel-based system, because it now takes advantage of multiple processors. The more processors you have on your system, the better it's going to work.
So those G5s are out the door.
G5s, it's going to require a minimum of 10.6, because it's going to need the 64-bit addressing.
I'd be surprised if we see anything short of Lion. I mean, when they said June, I looked at WWDC and I said, okay, well, it's going to come after that, and they're going to say this is a Lion-only release. I mean, I think.
You know, I don't know this one, but I would be surprised if that were true.
Okay.
Period.
Yeah. So it's
but an Intel Mac is required, absolutely.
It's definitely designed to scale. They talked about that. It's designed to scale from your Air all the way up to your Mac Pro. It's designed to take advantage of whatever you have there and literally suck up every ounce of energy that any computer has that's there. Now they dropped the price, $299, for this application. How do we think that this how do we think Adobe's taking this?
Well, I think any vendor, when you've got something that's this desperately different, has got to take a giant step back and think about what they're doing.
Right.
And you have to look at, what do we have that is, you know, if Adobe may be looking at this and saying, you know, we can speak to people that don't like change, because this is a way of go back to something that's stable, something that works, something that's a known quantity, and let this settle out. Avid could do the same thing.
Well, I think that the stability, I think, is definitely something that is going to be to their advantage. I think that also for Adobe, I think a lot of it's integration. I mean, they have stunning integration between After Effects and Premiere and Photoshop, and I think when I talk to people who are using Premiere, the number one reason they're using it is because they like the fact that it's so integrated with the other applications within the suite. And I think that they've done a much better job at that than Apple did with the Final Cut suite in a lot of ways.
Also, the fact that we're seeing in the industry that people need to have both editing and motion graphic skills.
Mm-hmm.
And the production premium, which gives you Photoshop and Premiere and After Effects as a bundle, is just incredibly powerful.
Now Andy, you have a lot of... The folks that you're talking to or the companies, there's a lot of people building a lot of web video, doing a lot of streaming, producing all these. Do you think that this is going to be a dominant editing platform for this kind of thing, especially. I mean, it already is to some degree.
Right. I mean, it already is, and it's been long overdue. Like, this is the update that they were waiting on. So right. I would imagine it's going to be as popular as everyone expects it to be. The thing that will be concerning or questionable is the UI so radically different that learning curve Larry was talking about becomes an issue. And, you know, they've had successes in that area before. They've had defeats in that area before. You know, they've had to make changes on, like, the iMovie and elements there. You know, ultimately, I think for the price point, I mean, I don't even use Final Cut day-to-day anymore. I'm still going to get it. Like, I want it. Like, I want that to play with. Of course I'm going to get it. Like, for $299... considering what I paid for it when it first came out, of course I have to get it. Like, that just seems crazy. The question I have and the thing I really was left wanting to hear about was what happens to the rest of the suite. Like,
right.
I really want to know what's going on there and what the plan is because, you know, I do actually use Compressor. I'm one of few.
Well, it'll be interesting. There are things that I'd be really surprised if we see DVD Studio Pro. I think that's not something Apple is considered. Once again, if you're going to put all the effort into rewriting an application and make do all that stuff, and you're looking at the trajectory of DVDs,
When do they stop making DVDs?
Yeah, and so you're just kind of like, well, let's see how that goes. I think that when I saw some basic power windows, you know, some secondary color control, color correction that's built in. I looked at that and I said, "Well, that's the end of color." You know, like I don't think that you have a real time solution that does that. And again, the rumor is that color when they bought it was a pretty a lot of spaghetti code, and so it probably would have been a lot of work to get that thing to kind of turn into something that was to convert it would have been quite a process. Taking those ideas though, and putting them into Final Cut, which is where it belongs. Mm-hmm. Almost everybody I knew was using Colorista. Everybody in our company was using Colorista, and they still are. I mean, and they're still happy with it, and they may still be using it in the future, I think.
It's been such a hard... I mean, I thought, oh, great, because I actually knew the guys down in San Diego that owned the app that became Color. I loved it because they were Mac-dedicated. I thought, this is a professional... I mean, we can do something with this. But when Apple bought it, I thought, this is going to be great. But the integration into Final Cut to do the export, take it out, put it back in, it was just too much work to do. And I just wished I could access that from a Final Cut timeline.
Because that's where you want to use it. Andy Beach is leaving us here. He's got another.
Sorry,
we're all in these one schedule after another. Thanks,
the
Andy.
The story of NAB.
Thanks for checking in, Andy.
Thanks, you guys. Thanks for letting me sit in.
Yeah, absolutely. And Larry, we're going to bring you down
towards
us as we're going here. Otherwise, we have a very uncomfortable space here. But a couple other questions from online. What are your thoughts about how Final Cut licenses will work in the App Store? Can you buy one copy for several computers on a network?
We don't know,
but the way every other app that we've bought so far is whatever computer that you're if you're logged in as you.me.com or you@me.com, whatever that whatever your Apple login is, every computer that's connected to that can install that application, which if that happens with Final Cut makes it even less expensive. It goes from $299 for me in my house, just my house, not my office, just my house, that would go from $299 to about $60. Because I got five, workstations in my house that would all suddenly, that are my logins. And so it'll be interesting to see how that turns out. We don't have any, they didn't talk about that at all, I don't think.
Didn't talk about licensing at all.
Yeah.
In fact, the first time they talked about pricing was last night.
Right. Now, one of the questions is the audio sync really effective, like Pluralize? We don't know, but...
Well, except what they said last night was something a little bit different. They did absolutely indicate that you could sync stuff by matching audio tracks, which is exactly what Pluralize does.
Right.
So although they did not address Pluralize by name, they described it in function just about perfectly. So
anybody,
that particular auto sync of double system sound is something that they're doing automatically.
Right.
Maybe we should look at the web and see if Pluralize is still on sale.
Did go on sale a couple of weeks ago.
Maybe somebody bought it, the company.
Yeah.
Or maybe someone licensed the technology. That.
Right.
I think that would have been the easiest thing to do is to, and a lot of companies do that, and I wouldn't be surprised if Apple just simply licensed that technology. Why write it on your own if you don't?
Exactly.
If you don't have to. And so hopefully, I'm hoping that they did. I'm hoping that the guys, because the Pluralize, the first time our editors used it, I asked them how it was turning, because we do all this 5D shooting and for interviews, and so there's a whole bunch of multi cameras, and then and then clean audio out of a 780T, and and we have to pull it all back in, and I looked over to my brother, was the editor, and he turned over. I swear there was a little tear in his eye. He's like, it worked so well. There's so many hours. I couldn't tell whether he was sad or happy, but there was so many hours of his time that were, you know, that were tied up in syncing these crazy files. And
Pluralize is just magical. And when you run it for the first time, it does incredible things.
Larry, we have a question online. What do you think is the best feature?
I think there's three things that really impress me. One is the ability to use what they call the skimmer. It's a new form of the cursor. And the skimmer, you've got the position of the playhead, and now you've got this sort of free-floating cursor that allows you to sort of zippy around inside files. And you can, it's a much faster way of reviewing files. And you've got the pitch-corrected slow-mo for audio, so you can actually hear what you're listening to as you're skimming around inside. It's a huge, huge feature, just being able to find stuff. Easily being able to select a range, a faster way of setting ins and outs.
Well, instead of doing all these subclips that we used to do, they're just select all these groups, right?
And then the other is the magnetic timeline. The first time I saw it, I thought, this has got to be the dumbest thing I've ever seen. And the second time I saw it, this is just flat-out brilliant. What it allows you to do is you move a clip. And if there's a clip there, it's like the Knight's bus on Harry Potter. All the buildings get out of the way, and the clip just sort of slides where you want it to slide.
But it doesn't override it. It doesn't delete, doesn't clip, doesn't block. It just simply moves everything.
Moves it around. And one thing that I'm not sure I like, but is interesting, is that there's no tracks anymore. The clips simply stack however you need them to stack. So that, remember how we would create a track and we'd put clips in it? Well, that's how I build effects in my head, is I know this is going on track one, two, three, four.
Yeah.
Here, they were just stacking stuff up. Yeah. And you weren't listening discrete tracks anymore. So I think one of the things they did not show is they didn't show any filters. They only showed a little bit like cropping, and they didn't show a lot of motion effects. So I'm really curious to see how they're implementing the effects engine, because that was definitely something that was missing in the demo last night.
Yeah, and we develop plugins, and I looked at that and I was like, well, I don't know. It doesn't look like FX plugs there. I mean, if it's sitting on top of Quartz Composer, I'm assuming that what you need is a Quartz Composer, you know, some kind of, you know, something to build straight into that, which is totally doable. I mean, for you know, it's just a matter of building the code inside a Quartz Composer. You can build a composition and figure that stuff out.
I was talking with the guys, Sean Seyfried at Red Giant Software today, and I said, so what do you know about this? He said, nothing.
Yeah.
So I think you're probably in the same boat that they are.
I am. As a developer, I came there very interested. I ran into a variety of Apple employees who said, I flew in to see this because I'm an Apple employee and I have no idea what they're doing. And this is like, and I'm not talking about random Apple employees. I'll leave them unnamed because you never want to quote an Apple employee directly.
They get fired.
Yeah, but it's like you're talking about people who are accountable for video in different parts of the United States, and they haven't seen a thing, you know. And so they're ready. They came in excited to see what happened. Some other questions that we have here from the online audience is, how is this changing? You know, FCP and Thunderbolt look like a great pair.
Oh, there I've got an answer.
Okay.
I was talking again to one of the senior engineers beforehand, and so I was talking about Thunderbolt. I said, help me understand this. Thunderbolt is a high-speed I/O system-level driver. So any Mac that's got Thunderbolt, any application is able to take advantage of it. He said that's absolutely correct. Final Cut doesn't need to be optimized for Thunderbolt any more than you need to optimize it for USB or FireWire. If you've got Thunderbolt on your system, every Mac application has access to that high-speed data. So if you've got a brand-new laptop, you've got Thunderbolt. NAB is showing Thunderbolt devices. Final Cut, Mac Word,
Skype.
Pages.
They have Skype. Skype on
if it goes out the display port or it's a high speed data connection, it's supported in Thunderbolt.
Well, and I think it's what I'm pretty excited about is the idea of sitting in the field with one of the new LaCie or G-Tech, you know, RAIDs that's 700 megabytes a second, and hooked with Thunderbolt in and editing and theoretically editing in a pretty seamless environment. It's for a news reporter, this has got to be a big big deal. Shooting with their 5D, doing great little interviews, and then throwing it up. It's quite a thing.
Yeah. We are very excited, Alex. And as speaking on behalf of all of us, I want to thank you from the budget of TWIM buying all of us new laptops and 700 megabyte
a
second
grades.
Yeah,
that's going to be great.
I am looking forward to that shipment arriving next week.
It's great because I'm going to work you for a month, 100 hours a week, as soon as you have it there. So it's really my pleasure. I'm really glad that you agreed to that because I was surprised. I was like, wow, he's really busy. But when he committed to 400 hours of news gathering in 1 month, I thought to myself, I'm
really
getting
nice
him
guy.
A laptop. That's all I'm saying.
There is no length to which we won't go to help you, really. That's
One of the questions one of the things we didn't see last night is multiple displays. They didn't talk much about it. They did mention it at the beginning. At the beginning, they talked about the fact that they were going to take advantage of multiple displays, but we didn't see that.
That one I can't answer.
There we go. So, but we did. They did say something about taking full advantage of the computer, taking full advantage of multiple displays. There was something. There was a reference to that at the beginning of the presentation. So we're going to assume that. But one thing they didn't show is anything that had to do with two displays there. So we don't know. It does look like a much more integrated process. So the final question before we move on. What do we think about the change in the source viewer? I guess the stuff coming in. I think that being able to the way you're able to manage clips on the way in, I think I'm pretty excited about.
And you've got multiple ways of doing it. You can look at it in the thumbnail view, which they showed us, being able to select ranges, which they showed us, being able to see it in list view, which they showed us, being able to find it by metadata, keywords, they showed us. So it's multiple slices of the same thing. What we're missing is all that ancillary metadata that's stored inside the browser that we're used to scrolling for 500 columns to find. Right. That they didn't show us. Nice. But in terms of how we view a clip, it's become easier. What they didn't show us is lots and lots and lots of different clips. Right. What happens if you've got 100 or 500 clips? There, I don't think the thumbnail is going to be as efficient as the list view is.
Right. So it'll be very interesting to see. Next thing we're going to jump into is cameras. But before we're going to wrap that up and jump into talking about some of the cameras that have come out here at NAB. Before that, we're going to thank our sponsor, Hover.com. At Hover.com is a really quick and easy way to get your website registered. A lot of us think about registration. When I think of a good idea, someone comes up with a business idea and they have a business name, I'm like, okay, so do you have the... we don't even need to have a discussion until we have it registered. Because if you don't have the URL registered, and if you can't, if it's going to be some funky registration of this / something or dash, think of another name. So one of the first things that we do is if I'm thinking about a business, even if I'm just thinking about it, I just could register it. It's $8, it's a couple of lattes. Now I have it, I have it protected, and now I know I can actually start thinking about it. And so you want to do that quickly, and you want to do it easily. The problem is you go to some of these sites who will remain nameless, and it is like a gauntlet. I mean, you're sitting here. It's not just something like, I can just go up and register it. It's like, can we add web services, and can we give you email?
Would you like fries with that?
Would you like fries and onion rings, and can we send you to the Seychelles while you're here? It's crazy. So what Hover does is that they stay focused on simply making it a really easy process to register your domains. It's not 50 sites. It is just simply 50 clicks to get to something. It's like, I want to register it, I'm going to buy it, and then I'm done. And Hover doesn't sell you all those services. That's not what they're focused on. What they do have, which is what oftentimes we really need, is a no hold policy for customer service calls. So Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern, you call, you're going to get a person. You're not going to be talking to a computer that says you can say this aloud or hit this button. What's even worse is when they say when they just ask you to say it aloud and you're talking to a computer and you can't figure out what is the code name that I have to say to get to the right thing. So usually I just go customer service. I just keep on saying it like over and over and over again until I get to a person. Well, you don't have to do any of that. Hover does that automatically. You're going to get a real person. Their job is to make it easy for you to register. Of course, you can use their management tool. They do have domain management tools once you get in to set up your email addresses, forward email addresses, redirect your domains, create URL extensions, set privacy controls, all with fewer clicks. You're not they have really focused in a very Apple-esque way. Mm-hmm. They have very focused on streamlining the process of doing one thing really, really well. So, you know, definitely you want to check this out. So go up there and go to hover.com. If you use the offer code TWIM, you're going to get 10% off. So it's already inexpensive. And
What was the code?
TWIM.
Thank you.
TWIM.
And how much they get off?
10%.
Okay, we got to get the important stuff across here.
Absolutely.
10% off of how much was it? It was like
I don't
low
know
as it was.
It's low. I mean, I'm not sure exactly.
You should go to hover.com.
You go to hover.com and find out. Yeah. I think it's 10, I want to say 10.95 or wow. something in that range. But it is a 10% off. Once again, it's hover.com/TWIM. Use the offer. So you can go there just to check it out. So hover.com/TWIM. Use the offer code TWIM. And if you're listening to this right now, just go to hover.com.
And if you buy more than two sites, you get a personal visit from Alex himself.
There you go.
Yeah, this is why we don't let Larry on very often.
It's time to get rid of Larry, and I've actually got to go as well. So you guys are going to have camera talk.
Are you here?
I've got to go.
He's got to go.
Darren and I are going to finish this conversation.
I can stay till Thursday night, like I said.
So we're going to be talking from Thursday night. Darren and I often say that we could talk for days about cameras.
Now you're going to prove
it.
No, I don't want anybody tuning up because it's going to be for days.
Alex, I need to do a live show, but I want to thank you so much for the invitation to
be on. And I'll see you in a little bit.
Yes, you will. Uh-huh. Back in the booth. Bring food. It's a long walk.
You're getting me back. I brought you all the way up here, and now I got to go all the way down there.
And visit us on digitalproductionbuzz.com because we got all kinds of interesting stuff to talk about.
Definitely.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks,
right.
Larry.
I'm going to run as well.
Where can people find you?
OneTimStreet.com, or if you're looking for dynamic video ad insertion on the iOS devices, mdialog.com.
Fantastic. Right.
Thanks. Cool.
See you, Tim.
And then there were two.
Yeah, God. They all come in the beginning because they think there's going to be food and drink, and then they leave.
They got through all the chips, and then they were like, okay,
exactly,
here we go.
Yeah.
So of course, one of the things that so you and I walked around yesterday. That was great.
That was
so much fun.
What a great idea. I mean, that was really fun to do with you.
You know, we've been talking about doing that, and we just waiting for the next NAB. And then when I saw you here, I was like, oh, I have an idea. You know, so for those of you listening. Darren and I walked around. We did kind of a camera talk. We started off at the Sony booth and walked to a Canon booth and around to a variety of different booths talking about cameras, talking about sensors. And we're going to get that up online in the next little bit. But it was a lot of fun to just have this very informal talk about what that is. Now, we've seen a lot of new stuff. I mean, we're starting to see some of the cameras that we've been hearing about.
Right, right.
So one of the big camera that people are talking about, the large camera that people are talking about is the D65.
Yeah.
Can you give us a little bit of a breakdown?
Or you mean the F65.
Sorry, the F60. I keep on calling the D65.
Well, maybe, you know, I can probably do stills also.
The F65.
The F65. Well, you know, it's a Sony's camera that they're hoping will define digital cinematography.
Yeah, and it's a pretty amazing. I mean, so this is an extension. We had the F35.
Correct, yeah.
And what we're extending to is the F65 is we're looking at a 8K sensor.
It's an 8K sensor that oversamples down to 4K.
Those of you listening, the important thing about that is that a lot of times these 8K any of these sensors have a little. Well, they say that they're 5K or 6K or 8K.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of errata. There's grain. There's all kinds of little things that are going on. And when you mush them back together, when you take that larger frame and you squeeze it back down to a smaller frame, a lot of that gets kind of blended back in, and you get back to oftentimes what the original image that it was taking. Because a lot of that little stuff that's changing gets blended in. Oftentimes it gets a little sharper.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the sensor design, or as the engineers call it, detectors, it's a CMOS, which is, you know, just like a lot of the other cameras, so there's a bare pattern going on. But what Sony's done is, if I understood this right, it's pretty much doubling every color record for that particular photo site. So
right.
There's green. If you had four green, now there's eight green.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing for blue and red. So you're getting more color fidelity in that bare pattern. For that particular photo site, and they've done that. Usually when you've packed that area, you lose dynamic range. It's contrastier. You lose color fidelity.
Right.
So it was amazing that they were able to do that. It's the same size as a Super 35 film frame. In that, there's like over 20 megapixels.
Now, we get concerned when you take when you pack that many megapixels into a small. I mean, it's big. It's a big film frame.
Right.
But when you start packing it in there, you start ending up with more errata, less sensitivity. There's a lot of things that, you know, one of the things that we saw with the way Panasonic started approaching their still cameras was we're going to go down to 12 megapixels, but we're going to give you more sensitivity. How does the sensitivity look on the F65?
It looks at least like 800 ASA.
Wow.
I was very surprised, and I've seen the footage. I saw the footage initially last week at Sony Pictures in a controlled screening room, and then subsequently seen it here again.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. It is color fidelity is just incredible. The color depth that it's capturing.
Right.
The film that
they have some 4K images that are kind of floating around.
Yeah.
So they are they have some at the AJA booth, and I think we've seen them in a couple places that are, you know, the images just look outrageous.
Well, a friend of mine, Curtis Clark, ASC, shot the film for them they're using.
Mm-hmm.
Mainly existing light.
Right.
Shot at a 1.4 with Leica lenses. That are being designed for 4K. So now there's all this talk about 4K lenses.
Well, that's a real challenge because you know the issue that you get into is being able to resolve to that resolution.
Right.
Yeah.
Or is it important to do that? Do you want a lens that has a romantic look? And as we were talking about yesterday, that romantic look is going to look better in 4K because the softness of it will be even softer. I mean, you won't.
It's still going to look the bandy. You're still grabbing that image, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. So,
but that camera is a little smaller than an F-35.
Mm-hmm.
It weighs about the same. I think they're planning to release it in the fall, is what I.
Right.
Heard this morning.
December, I think. Oh, okay. December is what I.
Yeah. So it's probably I mean, fall. Yeah. September to December. Some window.
Some that range. Yeah. Now, also, of course, one of the things that we're going to see that we saw earlier today here was on Twit was the Epic, and the Epic is starting to get out there. It's starting to shoot high dynamic range images up to 120 frames a second, 5K. I mean, some of the imagery coming out of it is pretty impressive.
Yeah, I saw some of the Epic footage yesterday, and it was impressive.
Yeah.
It's going to be a real close call. I mean, it benefits everybody shooting.
Yeah.
Because now you don't have, you know, you don't have like this is really horrible, this is great, but you can't use it because it's so expensive.
Yeah.
But you know, to Red's credit, they did wake everybody up.
And that's we've said this over and over and over again that no matter what you think of a Red, because I think it's for some people we shoot a lot on the Red, so I mean a lot is 5 or 6 production days a month we're typically on, you know, shooting on a Red, and so we deal with a lot of the footage, we deal with a lot of the images, we've gone through that, and we like the look, a lot of our clients like the look, but it is a different feel, like when you're
using
I have to admit that sometimes I really like all the dials on the outside. You know, like I know that clutters up the interface, but I like being able to know exactly where I'm going to get to something. And so with the Sony cameras, you get that kind of, I think that's a creature comfort for a lot of DPs or a lot of ENG shooters of having all that information. With the Red, there's a lot more interface, you know, that takes to get to certain things quickly.
Yeah.
And I think that people bristle at that. So I think it is, but it is much more from a geeky perspective. There's a lot of detail in there that you can grab.
Yeah, there is. My only opinion, and it's my opinion the Epic is where you end up with your final debayered file. What resolution is that really? Did you really capture 4K in every photo site it takes to make a 4K image?
Right.
And there's going to be discrepancies with that. I mean, hey, remember when Steve Jobs was talking about the whole megahertz thing wasn't true. I mean, this is exactly like that.
Right, because there's a real question as to whether, when you're looking at that, whether people can really need 4K on the screen at all. I mean,
exactly.
There's a lot of people that say you got to have 4K, but I have to admit, when the first projectors came out, they were 1024 by 768, and we were watching that, and we were saying, yeah, that looks pretty good. You know,
right.
Wow, it's digital.
Right.
It's not shaking anymore. You know, that's all we were paying attention to. I've projected on a large screen out of a DVD, is it as sharp? No, not necessarily. But once you get to 1920 by 1080, you know, I think that, you know, at HD, we get a lot of quality there.
Yeah.
And so I think that the average viewer, will my kids or my wife know any difference between 2K and 4K? Probably not.
Probably not, unless the 4K is lending the quality to the 2K that you couldn't get because you were just going pixel per pixel and not oversampling that.
Right. Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see, because I love the oversampled look from a lot of the footage that we get. You know,
yeah.
Like grabbing a 4K image and then bringing it down to 1080p. But, you know, there are some 4K projectors, and I do feel like you can reach out and touch something when you're doing that. So
I mean, there was, getting off the subject of the camera, I did see, have you seen any of the 4K displays? Now, I wonder if I can mention this, the one I saw this morning.
Oh, go for it. There's no one watching or listening.
I did go to one of the private suites.
Right, right.
And there's some of the employees didn't even know it was going to exist. It was a put-together prototype, incredible 4K OLED display.
Oh, wow.
I'll tell you, talk about reach out. The blacks were beautiful. And they were playing, this will be the hint, they're playing the footage from the F-65.
I wonder what company would have a monitor that would show that. Yeah.
It's something that is going. I don't know what it's going to cost. I don't even know if they know what it's going to cost. But you look at that image, and it's like Kodachrome. That's the only way I can describe it.
Right.
It's like Kodachrome right there. There is nothing about. I mean, you just. I mean, talk about. Something lickability. I mean that is beautiful. But
so they're hitting us in the wallet here because now we just bought our HD TV,
right?
And then I finally got persuaded to buy a 3D HD TV. I got my Panasonic
Miera,
and now I'm going to be pushed into a 4K. At least I hope they do the 3D and the 4K at the same time.
Right, right.
But I don't have to do it. I get four times.
You know, honestly, looking at the 4K OLED. Felt more like 3D than 3D did.
Because it's just so real, so rich. You don't realize what you're seeing until you're seeing that.
Yeah.
So, anything else that you saw at the show?
You know, the other high-end manufacturers, Aeroflex has their Alexa that
Alexa has been a huge success in Hollywood.
The Alexa has surprised Aeroflex with how many orders and the adoption of it. I mean, it came from a film company, not that we're looking at, people are Luddites and it's Aeroflex, so it's got to be filmic. They listened to filmmakers, made the camera so that the characteristics of the image were what cinematographers were looking for.
Right.
But they had no idea the demand was going to be what it was and the adoption.
Well, I think in many times we've seen companies not realize how much there is a demand by independent filmmakers to get out there and start shooting. When you look at, I don't think Canon saw what was going to happen with the 5D when they released it. I mean, that was like a surprise. That was like a record of the, it was like a little backup record, kind of thing. And we'll grab a couple frames, and before you know it, that's a huge part of the market. And so,
well, Alexa's doing a lot of television work, and the timing was kind of interesting because. A lot of the series ended up having to go to different an after contract, not SAG, when they had all that negotiation. So when Pilots happened, they signed a different contract. SAG had to be on film after it could be film or digital or video. So many of the shows that are on now had to find a better solution to shoot with.
That's
Alexa
really
just, it was just one of those times
they were
when
in the right place at the right time.
Exactly, and the right camera.
Wow, and a lot of times we never realize that there are all these political ramifications sitting in the back.
Right, right.
That drive sometimes the market as much as the technical considerations.
Yeah. What the, you know, the big news for us was that the Alexa has an optical view. They are going to introduce it with an optical viewfinder.
Now, why, for our listeners who are not necessarily camera people,
right?
Why is an optical viewfinder so important?
Well, you know, the electronic viewfinders give you. I mean, for us, we've been looking back. We've been, you know, looking back and forth at all the developments of electronic viewfinders. It just flattens out the image. It makes it look like you're looking at it somewhere else.
Yeah.
And we keep tossing this back and forth because we know the design challenges. And optical viewfinder, okay, so it flickers because it's alternating between your eye and the sensor.
Right.
There may be a ground glass there. But what it does is it gives you a sense of being in the – it opens your imagination up to being in the picture. And
right.
you know it's not being manipulated by anything else.
Right.
It, as you're shooting and lighting and adjusting the camera, you're doing it in a way that you know what it is, and the optical finder just kind of blends into it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's been this fight about the optical finders on electronic cameras for years.
Right.
And Aeroflex, you know, that was one of their – that was going to be their highest-end platform to do that. So they're doing it with a 4:3 sensor, which means we could shoot also with anamorphic lenses. We can use the entire even get more resolution out
right,
of it.
Right.
But it was exciting that they're actually going to build the thing.
Right.
It's going to cost a lot more.
Yeah.
It's not going to add. The optical finder doesn't add anything to the image quality except the 4:3 sensor. But what it does is it says we're a camera company that is making a digital camera that is meant to be used for storytelling.
Yeah. So it's a fascinating thing. It's all of this technology is moving so quickly. You know, when you look at how inexpensive a lot of these things are,
there's
a lot of drivers. I mean, there's one of the things I thought was interesting. There was a lot of solid state recorders has become a big deal. Now, one of the things that a lot of people, if you're listening, there's once again, we talk about the world issues that affect a lot of these things.
Mm-hmm.
So solid state has been building up for a while. So we saw, and we've seen the Key Pro took the industry by storm.
Yeah,
the Key Pro Mini is selling like hotcakes.
Incredible, yeah.
And then you have now Sound Devices, which is traditionally a sound company they now have a video recorder to SSD. Mm-hmm. You've got Convergent Design, of course, Astro Design.
Right.
Codex is the big heavy-duty
yeah,
and they have a nice miniaturized one.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing more stereo. But all of these things have all of these different pieces have been accelerated because of what happened in Japan.
Absolutely.
So what happened, I mean, so some of the backstory here is, the heart of many of these productions is SR tape. So SR HD tape is something that sometimes you can record two cameras onto it, you can record stereo onto it,
right.
You can record, or you can record 444 onto it, and it's just being used all over the place. And they made it mostly in Japan. They had one device here to make it in California. 3 months ago, they sent that back to have it resynced to the... the Japanese unit. And now the word is that it's covered with radioactive water. I mean, that's the entire factory.
Mm-hmm.
And so no one knows when SR tape is going to be...
ever available again.
If it's ever going to be available again. Yeah. Because now you're looking at, does it make sense to spend $500 million on building a tape factory for a technology that doesn't really... We all know that 5 years from now, we're not going to be using tape.
Right.
I mean, everyone knows that.
Mm-hmm.
The question is if you only have that – it's one thing to have a factory, you're going to keep it open because it's making money. It's another thing to reinvest in that as you move forward. And so Sony, anyway, we don't know, but the tape stock has gone from $100 a tape to $1,000 a tape.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, it's like buying gold.
I think I have some SR tapes at the office somewhere. Like we're moving, and I got to send the guys an email going, so there's some light gray cases, and those are worth a lot of money now. So
I think I have some SR tapes laying around somewhere that I had some tests recorded on. Maybe I'll be putting that up somewhere. But it's sad that that's happening. But the technology for solid state and flash was here, and I see productions that tons of tapes, and I think moving. Unfortunately, the events are having us move to that. But it's a positive move.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that it's what needed to happen. But a lot of companies that I've been talking to have moved it from 3 years from now, they're going to be all tapeless, to 3 months from now, we got to be tapeless because we just can't afford to keep on doing this. And it's so it's a very fascinating time as far as that goes. It's been a big boom for these manufacturers. I think SSD has also made a huge difference. I think that, you know, before, recording to a moving drive is scary for everyone, and it's just not as portable. It's not as durable. We're seeing most of the players are now becoming SSD players. We've got a couple questions online, and then we're going to have to close up here. Yep. One of the big things people are asking about is the HPX250, which I don't know much about. I don't know if Panasonic.
The Panasonic.
Do you know much about the new?
I do not know that much. And I was in the Panasonic booth this morning, just kind of getting
around.
The feel of it all. So
we'll take a look at that before the end of the week. Yep. I'll go over there and take a look at it. The other thing, ABC Ultra. Or Ultra ABC, the Panasonic's released up to 200 megabits.
Wow!
It is a it's up to 200 megabits. It is allowing a 24p 444 at 12 bit or 1080p 60p or 3D. So there's a bunch of different formats that this new format, and it's nice. It's exciting to see ABC.
Yeah.
You know, bumping into this higher piece until we get to play with it. 444, you know. As someone who shoots 444, I find that when you see 444, I'm like, well, let's take a look. I mean, it's fine. That what that means is that all the color it's fine that all the color is all equal. That's what 444 basically means. But if you compress it,
yeah, what do you
know? 200 megabits
out?
A second is not that big of a. That's not a big footprint. That's 30 megabytes a second, roughly. Maybe a little less, 25 megabits a second, 25 megabytes a second. Now, to put it in perspective, uncompressed 444 HD is about 180 megabytes a second. And if you do it in RGB, it's closer to 200. And at 30 frames a second, it's closer to 240 megabytes a second. So you're still talking about heavily, you know, highly compressed footage. Now, I will say that Apple ProRes 4x4
it's been amazing.
Pretty good to us. I mean, it's been much better.
I mean, there's a lot of productions that are shooting on Alexa. They're using that as their master.
Right. Now, one question we have online is, does it make sense for professionals to upgrade to 4K monitors when the audience is fractured over three different size screens and no calibration? And why do we even bother?
You know, my opinion is I would not
move
to a 4K monitor. Not now.
Right.
When it's less... But I do love the
But I would go over to your house if you bought one.
Exactly. I mean, there are some great monitors. I mean, the Dolby monitor is incredible.
Yeah.
The Dolby reference monitor. I mean, you get, you know, P3, digital cinema color, any color space.
Right.
Incredible brightness. You have blacks. That's an incredible... I mean, there's not a lot... I don't think there's going to be a lot of choice in monitors. I think there's going to be probably four that end up being... the ones to use as reference. It just matters how much it is.
Yeah.
Here, I wanted to show you the 1 terabyte.
Oh.
If we're talking solid state.
It's pretty light.
You know, when they handed that to me, and they said, here, this is for you. And I said, what am I going to record on it? And they said, oh, no, it's just, it's for your business cards.
So,
but that is the form factor of it.
Wow.
That's what it's going to be.
That's great. So this is what I'm holding right now. For those of you listening to the audio version, is an SR memory 1 terabyte. It's about the size of an SSD drive. I'm guessing that what they're putting in is an SSD drive. This 1 terabyte.
It's almost the size of your iPhone.
Yeah, it's actually just a touch smaller than my iPhone, in both width and length, and about the same thickness. So you can imagine your iPhone holding 1 terabyte of very, very, very fast footage, because this is the bandwidth on the new F65 is outrageous.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not sure exactly what it's putting out. To that card, but what's great is you're going to have all these solid state recorders. You can pick a recorder, use it on multiple cameras, different cameras. I mean, they're going to make recorders that go with that.
Right.
So, I think getting to a common format that now you can ingest into Final Cut Pro is going to be key to that whole speed situation.
Absolutely. So it's exciting. So anytime it's good, it's a good time. We're running out of time here. I have to go out and start. I have to go over to Larry Jordan's and do a.
Maybe
do
I'll go over and we'll, yeah,
we'll take over.
I'll take a look because I want to see what he has.
So we're gonna wander over there and I'm gonna do some more coverage of the show. So we're looking forward to that. Darren, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, this is great.
Yeah, it's good to have you.
You know, we've been wanting to do hang out for more often. But
one of the things a couple years ago, and I am embarrassed to say that I didn't follow up on this. A couple years ago, we started recording a digital cinema podcast. We had Ron Brinkman and Steve Wright and
that
you and I, and it just didn't. We couldn't quite all get all the. And I had two outrageously good, but I never launch a show until I've got six, and I had two outrageously good. One with you guys. And then I had one with Rick McCallum talking about you know digital distribution, but we couldn't quite get that turn. Yeah. But now is the time to really keep on talking about this, and so we're really looking at reviving that podcast. So we'll see if we can't pull you on.
Great,
very good. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Good to see you, Alex.
And this mess that you've been listening to is This Week in Media. We are over and out. This Week in Media is a Pixelcore.tv production produced by Suzanne Llewellyn with technical producers John Riley and Alutha Jamankar. Content contributor is Jason Perrier.